Our first speaker is serving our 5th district as a state representative. She is a graduate of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and she earned her law degree at DePaul University. She was born and raised on Chicago's South Side and currently lives in Brownsville. So in 2 minutes, you can come on up here, Juliana. All right. And then 3 quick stories about our second speaker. Several years ago, for years I was an advance guy for Senator Kennedy. All I did was hold his coat and do what I was told. But I met a guy named Irving Harris at the Standard Club. And Irving Harris was a businessman, charitable, civic, Irving Harris School of Government at University of Chicago, Millennium Park. But he was talking that day at this luncheon about, he used to give money to children in college, to go to college. You need money? Too late. Then high school? Too late. Then grade school. And by the end of his life, when he was about 95, JB, about 95, he was giving it to early childhood, the Erickson Institute, neonatal and prenatal. But the reason I mentioned that story, because someone has picked up the mantle and done that with no fanfare and no headlines. And he's our second speaker today. So that's number one. Number two. So our children, our second speaker's children, and our children went to a preschool up the road here, not far away. And when you're at those schools, you see the people, you know, see the other parents at parents' evenings, birthday, children's birthday parties, and school events. But a few years after our children graduated, and his children had also graduated from this little preschool, the woman who runs it, and she told me don't tell this story, but I'm going to tell it anyway. But the woman who runs this story, I went to see her one day because she called me about, I'm having trouble, Alderman Hopkins, with the loading zone and the traffic or something like that. She said, Jay, could you help me out? I said, I went over. So I went over to her office, and I noticed the classrooms were a lot nicer. And I noticed they had a nice playground. I mean, it really was, and painted it the whole bit. So I said, Mary Ellen, this place is absolutely beautiful. And she said, Jay. So I get a call from her today. I know somebody told this story. I probably am not supposed to tell you this, but J.B. Pritzker and M.K. were very helpful to our school. And what struck me was not the immense generosity, which was fabulous, but it was after children were all gone, nobody could do anything. It was no like, hey, I'm going to help you. Nothing like that. Again, no fanfare, no headlines. Third story. About 5 years ago, our second speaker, our featured speaker, spoke right here at the City Club on 1871. And he gave a fabulous presentation. And after everyone speaks at the City Club, my plan is I always call him. Jack, you were giving speeches. Other people, I call him and say, listen, thanks for coming to the City Club. We really appreciate it. So I called the next day over to his office. I said, Beth, his fabulous assistant, I want to just leave a message for, or is JB there? I just want to say thank you. And she said, he just started a meeting, got a bunch of people in there, but I said, no, don't interrupt him, just tell him I called. And she said, great, I'll tell him. But she said, there's one thing, he really appreciated that, you know, those certificates we had now, but he wants to become a member of the City Club. And I said, yeah, okay, fine, just hold on. And so, you know, he wants to pay his money for the City Club. And I said, and she said, just, you know, how much is it? I said, $50. She said, Jay, nobody has ever asked my boss for $50. And so I said, Beth, well, I am. And then I thought about it. I said, well, Beth, how about this? $50 for 50 years. She put me on hold for like 1 minute. And she said, Jay, you have a deal. Who do I give the credit card to? No fanfare, no headlines. That'll be J.B. Pritzker. Juliana, you're on.
Yeah. Thank you, Jay, for that introduction. And good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
And I want to thank each of you for welcoming me and JB to the City Club this morning. And if you would just indulge me before I begin my remarks for about 38 seconds. Over the last year and a half, I have not had a lot of time to see my dad, but he was kind enough to get up this morning. And I would love Dr. Henry Wiggins to please stand. So glad he's here. I'm excited to be here this morning to talk about something that impacts each and every one of us, but we simply don't talk about it enough. And that is the subject of mental health. In our homes, in our communities, in our classrooms, and in our workplaces, and yes, even in the powerful halls of Springfield, mental health is too often not a part of the conversation. Instead, we feed into stigmas that shame people into silence. We refuse to consider the root causes and offer substantive solutions. We don't address trauma, we compound it, and instead of caring for our mental health, too often we ignore it. There are moments, often after a high-profile act of gun violence, when the media and policymakers talk about the importance of mental health treatment, but those moments pass as quickly as they happen. And when it comes to many of our communities, the conversations about the importance of mental health treatment don't happen at all. But they should. There's no way around it. We need to talk about mental health when there is daily violence happening in communities here in Chicago and in communities all across our state. We need to talk about the trauma experienced by people who regularly hear gunshots outside of their window, who witness shootings, who've lost family and friends to gun violence. And it's not just violence. We need to talk about the trauma of a child who goes to school hungry and is wondering if they're going to eat again that day. And we need to talk about the trauma and ongoing stress created when a person can't find a job, has no access to health care, and is worried about whether or not they will make enough money to pay the rent. Dealing with poverty, violence, oppression, harassment, racism, sexism, all impact mental health. And yes, we need to talk about each of these topics individually, but if we don't talk about the impacts all of these things have on mental health, then we are only having part of the conversation. We have to connect the dots. Now, I'm a lifelong advocate for restorative justice and criminal justice reform, and it's how I approach this conversation, and it's how I approach most of my work as a state representative. I've seen firsthand how important mental health is across every aspect of what I do. I've seen it in students who told me that they don't want more police in their schools, they want more school counselors. And it's why I work to ban police booking stations on school grounds. I've seen it in parents who watch their children get expelled from preschool, primarily black and brown boys, but increasingly black and brown girls, expelled instead of getting the care and the resources that they needed. And it's why I passed legislation banning preschool expulsions here in Illinois. Instead of expelling our youngest children, how about we bring services to our families and interrupt the school-to-prison pipeline, which I call the preschool-to-prison pipeline. Let's interrupt it before it starts. I've seen it in my work reforming the criminal justice system, and I want to tell you a story about a woman named Maria who was kind and brave enough to share her story with me. Maria shared her experience in the criminal justice system in a way that has stuck with me ever since. She told me this. First, she was in prison, and then she went to prison, and then she came home to prison. For Maria, her incarceration didn't end when she was released from the Illinois Department of Corrections. It continued in a community so disinvested in, so under-resourced, that to her, it felt like another prison. And I was struck by that. I was struck by how many women in our prisons want to build better lives when they go home, how many want to be better mothers when they go home, but they end up fighting against a system that isn't set up to help them, and they end up enduring more trauma. Together, Maria and I, and so many other justice-involved women, introduced the Women's Correctional Services Act, and it helps women in prison get trauma-informed support specifically tailored to them. And when Maria came to testify on our bill, it could not have been a more powerful firsthand testimony. And I'm proud that the bill passed into law as the first of its kind in the nation, and that more women are now getting the trauma-informed mental health care that they need to successfully re-enter their communities. But the push for trauma-informed care can't end there. Yes, we need to focus on re-entry, but how much better would it be to talk about no entry? Instead of talking about how to best transition people out of prison, we could have fewer people in prison in the first place. And a focus on mental health and wellness in all of our communities is one way to stem the tide. Too many communities have been shut out from opportunity, from jobs and resources, factors that can cause intense stress and trauma, and they are left alone to deal with the impact. Now, these problems didn't start with Bruce Rauner, but through misplaced priorities, an unwillingness to work with others and bring people together, and historic mismanagement of this state, this governor has made everything worse. Communities already suffering from a lack of investment saw Bruce Rauner's two-year budget crisis destroy the little that was there to begin with. After-school programs, job training, child care, the services that help people contend with trauma and build better lives, they were all slashed by Bruce Rauner. On mental health care alone, 80,000 Illinoisans lost access to services because of this governor's 736-day manufactured budget crisis. 80,000 people. Only about one-third of those who need help have the means to receive it. And instead of acting to address our failings as a state, Bruce Rauner stripped tens of thousands more of the care that they need. Our communities are strong and resilient, but strength alone doesn't solve trauma. Getting back up and pushing forward is not the same thing as mental health care. Our families want to build better lives, but they can't do it alone, and they certainly can't do it when they're working against leaders who should be working for them. Now, I mentioned earlier in this conversation that I approach this as a lifelong advocate for restorative justice. I also approach it as the mother of three young women and as someone born and raised on the South Side. As a mother, I've done my best to protect my own children from violence and trauma, but all three of them have been affected. There was the Sunday that we walked out of church and saw someone come around the corner and shoot his ex-girlfriend. There were the nights that we spent in the emergency room with their friends who had suffered gunshot wounds. And there was the day that my youngest daughter came to me and told me that despite everything that I did and still do to protect her, that she was still afraid of what might happen to her. Mothers and fathers can't do it alone. Our communities cannot do it alone. This is a heavy lift because trauma is heavy. Reversing systemic disinvestment is heavy. Building healthy communities is heavy. But we can do this together. Langston Hughes once said, "I have discovered in life that there are many ways of getting almost anywhere you want to go, if you really want to go." When it comes to mental health, we can get there together by investing in our communities, creating economic opportunity, rebuilding social services, expanding access to health care, including mental health care, fully funding our schools, and bringing trauma-informed and restorative practices to a criminal justice system so profoundly lacking in such approaches to justice. We get there by electing leaders who don't shy away from the tough conversations, who know how to listen to our communities, and who are ready to bring people together and move us forward. And I am so proud to be in this race with someone, that someone, who is ready to be that leader for Illinois. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome J.B. Pritzker.
Thank you very much, Juliana. But before I begin today, I have a brief important announcement. I've decided that I'm not running for mayor. Well, thank you, Juliana, not just for your kind words, but also for your partnership in this race, in this campaign, and for your lifelong commitment to public service and to serving so many other people across our state. Juliana just outlined how mental health challenges impact our communities, not just some communities, but all communities. And with mental health issues as pervasive as they are, you'd think that mental health would be a priority in our state, one that would be talked about openly and honestly at home and in our schools and in the workplace, that it would be near the top of the agenda for policymakers and leaders. But it really hasn't been. For far too long, politicians from both parties have been too timid when it comes to shining a spotlight on and addressing mental health. Leadership requires action. But instead of change, our state has settled for the status quo, one where mental health care is treated as something meant to be hidden in the shadows, where children and families pretend to be okay, and others turn a blind eye, one where individuals suffer silently and stigmas grow. I had my own experience witnessing a stigma that people didn't want to talk about. When I was 7 years old, my father died. And what I didn't know at that age, but I very quickly learned, was that my mother was an alcoholic. With my father gone, my mother now had three young children to raise and had to suffer alone with this terrible disease. For 10 years, my brother and sister and I watched my mother struggle heroically to overcome her addiction. We were extremely fortunate because we had resources so she could afford treatment. That's probably what kept her alive for the next 10 years. But ultimately, her alcoholism consumed her, and she passed away just before I graduated from high school. I watched her suffer. I watched her carry the stigma that goes along with a disease that has kept so much in the shadows. It's hard for me to imagine what would have happened to us if she hadn't been able to afford treatment. Would we have lost her 10 years earlier? But without resources, that's frankly what families face today, whether their loved one is an alcoholic or addicted to drugs or has a mental health challenge. So I will fight for a budget that funds substance abuse treatment and mental health services because I believe that every individual who struggles with addiction, like my mother, or those who struggle with mental health issues, deserve to be supported. They deserve to not only survive, but also to realize their full potential. And let me just say that watching what Bruce Rauner did to addiction and mental health services during his budget crisis shook me to my core. Families were turned upside down. It is and was unconscionable. 27 public health departments across our state had to reduce staff or services. More than 1,000 mental health workers and substance use clinicians were laid off or had their hours decreased. 80,000 Illinoisans lost access to services. Take the Wells Center in Jacksonville, Illinois. After serving the community for 49 years, the Wells Center was forced to close its doors and lay off 68 of its staffers. The opioid epidemic in central Illinois didn't go away when the center closed, but people went untreated and families suffered. Or the Rosecrans Triage Center, a not-for-profit behavioral health organization based in Rockford. They offered vital inpatient and outpatient behavioral health services 24 hours a day. But in 2015, the budget impasse forced Rosecrans to cut back to 11 hours a day. Now think about the consequences of that. Individuals in crisis who encountered police had to be put in jail rather than being treated. Others were brought to emergency rooms and were kept there overnight until staff could arrive at Rosecrans to support them. Getting treated like a criminal or not getting treatment when you're in crisis, these are the human costs of failing to prioritize addiction and mental health treatment. If we want to prioritize these, we need to internalize that addiction and mental health do not exist in silos. They are part of our overall health as human beings. That's one reason that I feel so strongly that we need to reform our broken healthcare system. Healthcare is a right, not a privilege. And that includes mental health care. But it sure doesn't seem like Bruce Rauner agrees. Because he was silent when Donald Trump attempted to take away a million people's health care in the state of Illinois. And again last month, he vetoed a bill to protect Illinoisans from junk health care plans that would allow insurance companies to deny coverage for pre-existing conditions like mental illness and addiction. We need to finally acknowledge that mental health, that is the health of our brains, is not separate from the health of our bodies. I understand that mental health must be woven into the fabric of public policy. That's why so many of the policy plans that I've rolled out incorporate mental health components. You will see that my opioid plan recognizes the increased danger of drug addiction in patients with mental illness. My plan will restore treatment, housing, and workforce development supports that were decimated under Bruce Rauner. And we will look for ways to expand capacity across the state for treatment services. Bruce Rauner proposed slashing funding for addiction treatment by 20%. And a 2016 study placed Illinois in the bottom three states for providing publicly funded addiction treatment. Bottom three. Healthcare companies need to help, and they need to cover addiction like any other condition. You'll see that my veterans plan commits to working with communities so we can recruit and retain qualified medical personnel and expand access to health care, including mental health care, particularly in rural areas of our state. According to the RAND Center for Military Health Policy Research, 20% of veterans, 20%, who served in either Iraq or in Afghanistan suffer from depression or PTSD. 20%. If we want to honor these men and women as heroes, as appropriate, let's get them the treatment that they deserve. And And you'll see that my domestic violence prevention plan puts an emphasis on counseling and therapy in addition to legal services and shelter and job training to provide survivors of domestic violence with the resources to successfully deal with and leave abusive relationships. Studies show that children who witness domestic violence struggle in school and they struggle with social development. Survivors and their families need trauma-informed care that domestic violence shelters can provide. But those shelters have suffered massive cuts or were eliminated by Bruce Rauner's budget crisis. And you'll see in my commitment to LGBTQ rights that I believe that we must invest in social service agencies, including mental health providers, that address the unique challenges facing the LGBTQ community. Unlike Bruce Rauner, as part of a balanced budget every year, we will actually fund programs for homeless youth, mental health, and HIV prevention testing and treatment. A governor should understand the interconnected nature of mental health in all aspects of public policy. Because if we prioritize mental health, we prioritize saving lives. And because it's the fiscally responsible thing to do. Let's be clear, investing in mental health treatment and prevention saves money. For example, the most intensive level of community-based mental health treatment for the most serious conditions costs an estimated $28 per day. The alternatives, psychiatric hospitalization, costs $944 a day. Locking someone up in jail for the day, $190. So don't let Bruce Rauner fool you. Don't let Bruce Rauner fool you. Slashing substance abuse treatment and mental health services is not saving our state money. It's costing us money, and it's devastating lives. And the conversation that we're having right now, this isn't a conversation that was happening much when I was growing up. People didn't talk about addiction or mental illness. Society didn't understand it or didn't want to. And to be honest with you, when I was a kid, there were times when I was unable to talk about my mother's alcoholism. But advocates and brave individuals, some of whom are in this room today, chose to speak up and challenge the status quo. They understood that addiction and mental illness do not define the content of one's character. The courage of these leaders is why I am comfortable sharing my own story. Yes, my mother was addicted to alcohol, but that didn't define her. When she was sober, she was fantastic. She was brilliant. She stood for progressive values and instilled those in me. She was a fighter. She's why I'm the man I am today. And it's why you can rely upon me in the fight to address mental health and addiction and to discuss these issues without shame or stigma. When I'm governor, we will chart a new course, one that is stigma-free for our children and our grandchildren. They will live in a state where we invest in preventive services, vital resources, allowing everyone to live full, successful lives. As I look around, I see a lot of familiar faces. There's a lot of power and influence in this room. And I have to be honest with you, none of us alone, not even a governor, can eliminate stigma when it comes to addiction or mental illness. So we need to talk. What are we going to do to end the stigma? What are each of us going to do today? Well, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. If someone in my family or a friend comes to me and says, "I'm struggling," I will never judge them. I'll support them. And if someone in your family comes to you and says, "I'm struggling," help them. Offer to help them seek the treatment that they deserve. And that's what we all need to do. We need to tell people who are struggling that we support them. We will listen to them, judgment free. That will go a long way. There's no quick fix when it comes to addiction and mental illness. But we can help change the culture in our state. We can insist that everyone deserves to live with dignity and that everyone deserves the opportunity to live independent, full lives. We can end the days of turning a blind eye to addiction and mental illness. Because when I'm governor, substance abuse and mental health will be at the forefront of my agenda. Thank you all very much.
Hey, an exciting morning. Thank you for being here, all of you. We have more than 340 people that are actually in the audience today. So thank you very much for supporting this event. Special thanks to Julianne and JB for being here. We are delighted that you have taken the opportunity to address the City Club today. So thank you for being here. Before I get into the questions, I wanted to mention something very important here, which is, as you know, the City Club is very much involved in every community event. This year, the Misericordia Heart of Mercy Ball, which will be hosted at the Hilton Hotel and on November 16th, will be awarding three individuals recognizing three individuals. The first will be the Heart of Mercy Award, which will go to Andy Glewart, Sterling Bate. Sister Rosemary Connolly Service Medallion, which will be given to our own president and his wife, Colleen, and Jay. Jay, thank you. Congratulations on that. And Pillars of the Community Award, which will go to Connette. Thank you very much. For that, let me say that as I was listening to the conversation and the speech that you were giving, and I was reviewing the questions that I received from the audience, actually were all related to substance abuse, behavioral health, mental health. And I'm going to repeat some of those questions, but I'm going to give you an opportunity to say more about it. So I'm going to begin with a question that I got from our esteemed state representative, Sarah Feigenhalt. Sarah, it's great to see you. And the question is, can you talk more about your health care plan and how mental health is incorporated? As you know, traditionally, we have work in silos, so mental health is treated separately. And physical health is treated separate. Can you expand in your plan?
Thank you. Should I do it from here or there? Let me thank you for the question. Of course, Sarah Feigenholtz has been a real leader in Springfield, as many of you know, on issues important to people who don't have health care coverage today and on really every issue related to health care in the state of Illinois. Let me say that expanding coverage in the state of Illinois is a priority of mine, and that's why I put forward a plan called Illinois Cares. Now, there are those who think that the only way that you can expand coverage in a state is by spending a lot more money. Now, at the federal level, there's a lot of discussion about a universal health care plan, Medicare for all, lots of proposals at the federal level. We don't need to wait for the Republicans in Congress or the president to come around to my perspective on universal health care. But we do need to make a change here in the state of Illinois so more people get covered. And so I put forward a plan called Illinois Cares, which is a public option. And I'd like to take credit for it, but it was proposed by President Obama in 2009. They weren't able to get it passed in Congress, but we can get it passed in the state of Illinois. And it doesn't cost the taxpayers anything. It allows people to buy into our state health insurance plan.
It allows people to buy into, at cost, our health insurance plan. So people who are currently paying a lot of money for a private health insurance plan can put $2,000 or $3,000 back on the table by choosing the public option. And it will force healthcare companies to think about lowering premiums on the plans that they offer. I think it'll be great for allowing small businesses to offer health insurance to their employees, which now is often very expensive for small businesses to do. So we can do that. I think it'll cover many more people in the state of Illinois, lower the cost for people who are covered today. And on mental health care, it's important that we mandate that our Medicaid system and the system people will be buying into cover those important services that I was talking about, to make sure that people are not afraid to come forward to seek that treatment that they need because they think, my God, I may not be able to afford it. So to me, affordable health care, making sure that everyone has access to it, is of critical importance. Mental health should not be treated in any other way than we do physical health. It is all the same body.
Another question regarding health, and this is from Justin DeJohn. He's from the American Medical Association. And the question is to either one of the two of you, with the opioid epidemic up in Illinois, what do you as governor hope to do to combat this epidemic?
Well, let's start with, let's not close the available treatment that people can get across the state of Illinois. And in fact, expanding the availability of services while under Bruce Rauner, opioid addiction has increased. We need to make sure that we're addressing it at its root cause, as well as when people are suffering from it. Now, it took years for Governor Rauner to finally capitulate on the subject of medical marijuana and it being a replacement for opioids. Finally, Senator Harmon is here. He was very involved in this. Finally, people can actually access through their doctor medical marijuana as a replacement for opioids. And that will help reduce some of the addiction problem across the state of Illinois. But making sure that we're thinking holistically about the opioid addiction problem is critically important. Under Bruce Rauner, we've fallen among states. We've fallen in our treatment, and we've fallen in the aspect that we have more people that are now addicted than were before. We could have been addressing this for the last 3.5 years. Where has he been? He has failed in this regard, and it's something that is, frankly, life-threatening. And for Governor Rauner, who focuses a lot on productivity, it's productivity-threatening. It's a problem and a challenge for us as a state that we have to address. And remember, we save money. We save money when we treat it like the health care challenge that it is, and we offer the services for people who need it.
Well, I would just add that, you know, with any organization, all of you know that the chief executive officer has the responsibility of presenting a budget. And when we talk about, and JB touched on this, when we talk about going 736 days in our state without a budget, without even proposing a budget, and then not working with people to get it done, I know it seems like it's a little on the side, but it's not. It's very central to what happened, because when these organizations, many of you may be representing some of those organizations, just because we were able to get a budget passed this year or last year, the damage that was done for it being going 2 years without a budget means that our communities and these organizations don't just bounce right back. It's going to take years. It's going to take years. So one of the other things, in addition to the very specific things that JB talked about, is we also have to make sure that we have a leader that's going to make sure that one of the primary responsibilities of the chief executive in presenting a budget is done every year. That has to happen.
Great. Thank you. Moving on with another question by someone by the name of Christina Soharik. I think I trashed the last name. My father is a vet. I am concerned about their care and those coming home now with depression and post-traumatic stress disorder. How can the state help them, and how will you help this group of veterans who are coming back to us?
So again, I've been very specific. We put out a plan to address the challenges that veterans have when they're coming home, particularly. I talked a little bit in my speech about the problem of PTSD, that many people are suffering in depression, people who've served in combat, but so many others too. And our veterans are heroes, whether they were in combat positions or not. They're heroes. They volunteered to protect us. And we owe them the services that, frankly, they were promised. I don't want us to ignore the fact that the federal government has a lot to do with whether these vets are being served, and the VA is challenged. They're just our major challenges, and it continues to be under this current administration. So, look, we need a governor who's going to speak out about that, who's going to make entreaties to our federal officials, not just Illinois officials, but the federal government on behalf of veterans. But here in the state, we have veteran services that we can make sure are offered. For example, I believe that we need to provide incentives for businesses, more incentives for businesses to hire veterans when they come home. Critically important in the first 6 months when a veteran comes home, that they are provided or find housing, that they find a job, that they know where their health care is going to come from, that the services that they're already owed are made available to them. And yet, for the most part, many fall through the cracks. And after 6 months, when people are unable to find a place to live, unable to find a job, they sometimes fall away entirely. These are the people that you run into who are not getting services. You run into them because they're not even getting homeless services today because of Bruce Rauner. And we've got to make sure that we're doing everything that we can to reach out to those veterans as they're coming home to make sure that they're getting the health care as well as all the other housing, affordable housing, a critical important issue for veterans. And that's something that, you know, when you're not thinking holistically about a problem, you know, all the things that I've tried to accomplish that you've heard about, whether it's building 1871 or expanding the school breakfast program or in early childhood education, you've got to look at it holistically. And every aspect of it, and you're trying to solve for a problem, not some tactic. It's a strategy. How do you deal with and think of it through the eyes of that veteran when they come home? That's what we're going to do.
Yes. Great.
Okay. Moving along here, a question from Kathy Carmody. She is from the Institute of Public Policy for People with Disabilities. The question is, what will be the top three priorities of your administration in the social service arena once you are elected?
Top three priorities. Nobody's asked me that. I mean, as you know, somebody along the campaign trail, people often ask, you know, what's the first thing you're going to do when you become governor? What's the first priority? I always say, gosh, there are 17 plates and flaming torches that you've got to be juggling in this state. There are so many challenges that we have to meet. So forgive me if when I name a few and you feel like something's been left out, it's not because we're not thinking about it, but just because you've asked for three. So and I'll ask Juliana to help and fill in here, too. But let's start with the challenge that exists on a broad basis. When you defund human service agencies the way they were defunded, and I think the comptroller knows this probably better than anybody else in the room, when you defund human service agencies in the state and they diminish in size or they close altogether, it's not like you can snap your fingers or just send an appropriation down the line, finally, to just reopen it and everything is back to where it was. When an agency closes, or people are laid off, and I talked about the 1,000 mental health care workers and substance use clinicians that were laid off. It's not like, you know, where are you going to find them again? You know, when you're back in Jacksonville trying to open a center again, where are they going to come from? You have to work hard. It took years. Remember, these agencies were started by somebody, an entrepreneur of sorts, who said, we have a problem here. I'm going to go start this thing. Then I'm going to go seek the state support to provide those services and expand them. Well, now, if they're gone, you need another entrepreneur. It may have been years. That one's 49 years old. The entrepreneur may not be around anymore. Who's going to do that? And so you need a governor and a lieutenant governor and a government that's thinking about rebuilding the infrastructure to provide these services. And there are so many, I almost can't name three, but I mean, so many things that we need to do. The number of homeless people that got shut out, the number of people who needed substance abuse treatment who couldn't get it. And I don't know how many people may have gotten worse or even passed away as a result of not having it available, whether it's in Jacksonville or in all the other places that suffered. And remember, the agencies that closed were the ones in the neighborhoods that needed it most, because those were the least funded ones. They have the lowest balance sheet. They don't have resources. So many others were, you know, digging into their balance sheet. They had a bank that was willing to float them for a little while. But the others, the ones in the poorest neighborhoods, they didn't have that. And they went away. So let's think about the Marshall Plan that we're going to need to rebuild those services across the state. I'm sorry if that didn't sound like three. It's about, you know, it's about all the agencies across the state. Do you want to add anything?
Well, I think the only thing that I would add to that, because JB and I often talk and have a lot of conversations around taking this holistic approach and connecting the dots, but I think something that isn't often thought of as a way to help is, but it does, and that is how much we talk about economic inclusion and needing to create jobs in this state. And if you think about it, for all the families that are experiencing so much trauma and don't have access to resources, one of the best ways for them to have access to resources is for us to create jobs in this state and to make sure people can work and to make sure people are making a livable wage and have access to the health care. All of those things are going to help us as we think about our social service safety net, because there'll be fewer people who will be reliant on that, and then we will have it available and help rebuild it for those who do need it. And I think that's really important for us to, that we talk about quite a bit.
Thank you to both. Let me proceed with another question by Ladine Kimball, a psychiatrist. The question is, will you support the 12-step bipartisan contract for Illinois to reduce gang crime and murders by at least 50% in 2019, saving life and tax dollars in the process?
Look, the problem of gun violence in our city is not standing alone in the state of Illinois. There's actually a higher incidence on a per capita basis of gun violence in Rockford and in Springfield than there is in the city of Chicago, or so I've read. And I must say that this problem is once again something that we've got to think about in a holistic fashion. It's not just about banning the implements of it, you know, or reducing the implements available. We've of course got to go after those and make sure that we're passing a gun dealer licensing bill in the state and banning bump stocks. We've got to go after the implements, no doubt, and you know, the majority, as many of you know, of the gun crimes that are committed in the city of Chicago are committed with guns that came from across the border. So we've got to deal with that problem. But it's so much more than that. And Juliana was kidding on it when she talked about jobs and when we were talking about social services. You know, when you shut off social services and make them inaccessible to people who are desperate, and that's their last connection with civilized society, many people feel themselves to have nothing left, and gun violence may be the next step for them. When you cut funding for Cure Violence and Ceasefire, the violence interruption programs on the street that were so effective, when you cut funding for those in Springfield, and I mean in the city of Springfield, for the city of Springfield, and for the city of Chicago, and across the state of Illinois, guess what happens? Gun violence increases. And guess what? When they were cut, it happened. You can see the reduction of funding at the same time that gun violence increased across the state of Illinois. Those social services are a critical component of preventing gun violence. And the last thing I'll say is, again, this is about a holistic challenge. It's related to stable housing. It's related to whether somebody has job training and an education available to them. These are all connected to one another. So I want to make sure that everybody sees this as a broad issue for us to tackle, but it can't be tackled by just one thing. We absolutely need to say for the state of Illinois that gun violence is a priority for us to reduce and that we will tackle it as Lieutenant Governor and Governor.
Giuliani, anything you want to expand on that or just got it? Thank you. Let's move on to the second one. This call is from Justice Bertina Lampkut, from the Illinois Appellate Court. I am very concerned about the underfunding of pension plans for the police, for the Chicago police, firemen, and others. What is your plan to help them to solve those problems?
This challenge exists for the city of Chicago as it does for municipalities and counties across the state, so it's not isolated here. But let's start with, we need to have a dialogue with all the municipalities at the table and all the counties at the table about what it is that we can do to help in each individual circumstance. They're different across the board, by the way. Some are better funded, some are worse funded. The city of Chicago has has its own particular challenges. But dealing with the pension problem crisis in the state of Illinois is a high priority for us, for Giuliana and for me, and for the state. If we're not addressing this problem, both at the state level and helping municipalities and counties at the local level, then we're not dealing with the enormous financial and fiscal challenge that we've got going forward. It hasn't been dealt with at all for the last 3.5 years. It's easy to talk about it. And then to say, as Governor Rauner says, with no other alternative, he just says, let's freeze property taxes. Well, I want to lower property taxes in the state. But the only way you could talk about a freeze or lowering property taxes if you talk about, well, how are you going to fund schools? How are you going to fund pensions? How are you going to do the things that you want to do? And I've been very clear about ideas that I've put forward. And I want for us to have a real dialogue in the state, because this is not going to be, and this is a big ship of state. It's an aircraft carrier. And we've got to turn the aircraft carrier. And that takes real effort, and it takes all of us here in this room and, frankly, all across the state of Illinois to do it. It's not like you're going to elect two people to office and all of a sudden, we're taking a hard, turn one way or another. It's going to take real effort by all of us, but it has to be dealt with, and it has to be dealt with very honestly in our state. So we're talking about revenue, we're talking about efficiencies in government that we need to bring, and talking about how we're going to bring municipalities and counties together in order to try and address the problems that are common among all of those municipalities and counties.
Okay. Thank you. Well,
there are a lot of
really
questions
coming into one of these spicy question here today. And this one is coming from Richard Jackson. The question is, thus far, your campaign has dealt with all of the Rauner lies with great dignity and restraint. How will you respond if he gets really nasty as we near the elections?
I thought we were there already.
One of my favorite movies is Spinal Tap. It goes to 11. Look, I, you know, I think public service, you know, requires some dignity. I think that you, you know, I've known a lot of people who serve in public office, and I have great respect for, and have watched them over the years. And I'm talking about people that I worked for too. You know, I worked on Capitol Hill. I worked for two United States senators and for a congressman. When I was young, I worked for the only Holocaust survivor ever elected to the United States Congress. And I worked for the civil rights governor of North Carolina, Terry Sanford, and for our senior senator, Alan Dixon. Frankly, these were all people who had real dignity and I think who carried themselves well in public life. And didn't resort to lying and didn't resort to you know, low blows, and so that's how I learned. That's how I learned, and I'm not going to change. I don't know, you know, how nasty it can get. I guess I've seen it because I worked hard to try to defeat Donald Trump in 2016. When I started this race, you know, I have teenagers. When I started this race, when I thought about it anyway, I sat down with them and with my wife. But my wife, you know, knew what we might be getting into, but our kids maybe didn't. And I sat down and I said, you remember what happened in 2016? You know, it was just months earlier. And you saw how bitter it was and how many lies were told and how awful that was. And I said, it's possible that if I run for governor, that those attacks will come at me, those lies. And I said, look, we just have to know who we are. We have to know what our values are. We're jumping into this because we want to do something great for the state of Illinois, that we want to stand up for working families across the state. And the only way to do it is to throw yourself into the arena, that old Teddy Roosevelt line that you no doubt many of you know. And we've got to be brave and jump in and do it and know that we're going to meet headwinds and there are going to be people who say things about us. But when we get to the other side, win or lose, you want to be able to look yourself in the mirror and say, I fought hard for what I believed in, the things that my mother taught me, the things that I'm trying to teach them. So I'm not going to change, no matter how bitter this race may get.
So I think I just want to add to what JB said. What we're going to do as well is we are going to tell the truth. We're going to tell the truth about what is happening in our state and the damage that's being done, regardless of where he goes. And there's a reason why people go that negative, by the way, and I know you all already know that. There's a reason why people decide to take that tactic. We're going to tell the truth. We're going to keep listening to people all around the state, and that's what we do. And many of you say, I see you everywhere. It's because there are 102 counties in this state, and we want to touch all of them. Everyone in every county matters. So we're going to do that. And we're going to talk about, as much as we can, what we are going to do for the state of Illinois and the people of Illinois. I have heard so many people, JB and I both have heard so many people say, you know what? I'm tired of the gridlock. I'm tired of the fact that I hear these words impasse and crisis and people not working with each other and so much partisanship. We want to be the kind of leaders that this state deserves, which is the kind of leaders that brings people together, the kind of leaders that recognize that we have to reach across the aisle if we're going to get anything done, the kind of leaders that are going to say, let's talk to each other and build relationship, because that's how things get done in our state. So that's what we will counter the negativity with. And if we have to tell the truth, and the truth may hurt for that person, we will tell the truth.
That we've done. I think we are kind of getting to the end. We're running out of time. I wanted to really thank Juliana and JB for being here. I think it was very clear that they have outlined a political platform, a commitment on public service to our state. I saw the level of passion of those issues that are important to the two of you. And we really want to thank you for actually being here. Please join me to welcome them.